All right, I think we're going to get started. My name is Bob Hartland. I work at Baylor University and have the pleasure of introducing two colleagues today. Before I do so, though, I got some housekeeping to do. First and foremost, the presentation will be recorded from what I'm told. They hope to end up a little bit early so that we can have some questions addressed and answered. Secondly, encouragement, as always, to fill out the form on the presentation. I'm told that a link is on the homepage for the conference. Lastly, in terms of things I'm supposed to do, they gave us some cybersecurity initiatives. This is an EDUCAUSE policy analysis and advocacy bulletin that we'll have up front if you want to pick one of those up. All right. To introduce the presentation today, two views on partnering with General Counsel to improve IT security. The presenters are John Allen. John Allen is Information Security Officer at Baylor University. He holds a BA in Political Science and is currently completing his MS in Computer Science. John is also a CISSP. He's been working in the information and network security field for almost 10 years. One thing he didn't write, but I'll say, is that he's a homegrown product. We hired him as a student worker many years ago. He'll be co-presenting with Chris Holmes. Chris is an assistant general counsel for Baylor University and practices in a variety of areas with emphasis on privacy, security, and legal issues relating to the use of information technologies. Before joining Baylor in 2002, Chris served as general counsel for Dallas Baptist University, as in-house counsel for the technology communications also as an in-house counsel for a technology communications company in Dallas, and practiced with the law firm of Kroll's and Thompson, also in Dallas. Chris holds his BA in political science from Baylor University and a JD with honors from the University of Texas in Austin. They wanted me to mention, to emphasize the fact that the issues are fresh. Out of the Washington Post this week, a study from the Fordham University Center of Law and Information Policy, they had an article that they released about mismanaging student information. They said the study concluded, a couple excerpts here, the study stated that states often collect far more information about students than necessary and fail to take adequate steps to protect their privacy, a national study concludes. And lastly, the study also recommended that states tighten the protocols to keep data anonymous. So with that, John.
Good morning, everyone. I guess we've got another 20 minutes of morning left. So I am John, this is Chris. To start off with, we want to give a little bit of context about who Baylor is. I found a lot of times when you come to these presentations, if you don't get some context about the institution, it's really hard to understand the inner workings of what we're talking about. So to start off with, we were chartered in 1845. We are the largest Baptist university in the world, approximately 14,000 students, a private institution, so mid to larger size private institution. 2,225 full-time employees and approximately 6,500 Baylor-owned computers. To go on with that, here's our IT organization. We have a central vice president over technology and also dean of libraries. So we're one of the models that unites those two fronts. We've got Becky King, our associate vice president, and who just introduced us, Bob Hartland, over security, IT, servers, and networks. I fall under him with the IT and physical security. One of the things I think is really important in the talk today that we'll be addressing is we are a very centralized IT organization. As a result, we have a lot of control and a lot of information coming in from campus about initiatives that other departments want to do, about having an understanding and making sure that controls are in place, that everybody has the same approach when we're going in and talking about IT projects. Taking a little bit of a look at general counsel's side. Chris Holmes, assistant general counsel. The nice part about general counsel is they also encompass risk management. So we've got IT security, risk management, general counsel, all kind of on the same playing field in communication with each other as we go through and talk about things. The other thing I would highlight is that they also have a very direct line to the board. So that can be very advantageous when we're talking about IT security. One of the things that I like to point out is we have gone through a lot of transitions in IT security in the last 4 or 5 years. The original model with IT security was that you had a computer, it was in a computer room, you had your punch cards, and at the end of the day, everybody locked the door and went home, and that was security. Now, that's obviously evolved significantly. We then came to a model where we were building the fortress. It's a classic castle model. You know, we'll put up our firewalls, we'll put up our intrusion prevention system, we'll make sure that all of our data is in the core of our infrastructure and that we know where it is and that it has great protection around it. That worked for a number of years. Then came the great internet and the great mobility and where we stand today. And I think one of the challenges that we have, not only on the security side, but I think also Chris would agree on the legal side, is adapting to the models where our traditional security controls will no longer function. What we have done traditionally in IT security, in another few years, we will be doing very little of that as far as traditional controls. Where you will see that is, especially as you move data into the cloud, you're not going to be administering firewalls out there anymore. You're not going to be the one managing the authentication necessarily around those environments. And you're going to have to look to things like policy, contracts, compliance, encryption to actually provide the controls you need in an IT security environment. That's a pretty drastic change. That's kind of going from being a traditional technology person of administering technology and making sure those controls are in place to somebody who's really overseeing policies and contracts and things that many times a lot of security people originally had overlooked. Now, we've seen this evolution taking place for a few years, so I'm sure to many of you, this isn't a new approach. Now, for those in the room, how many are attorneys? Okay, got a couple of attorneys. How many are IT security professionals? Okay, so we've got kind of a nice mix. Hopefully, this will kind of bring some ideas. We're not preaching the gospel on this. I think we did some things right. We probably did some things that we could have done a little bit differently, but hopefully you walk away with some value.
10 years ago, what laws did we have in the area of higher education dealing with the data? Realistically, we had, I remember when I first moved into higher education, it was about 8 years ago, the attorney that I was going to be working with kind of said, hey, you really just need to get up to speed on FERPA. And from a security standpoint, FERPA doesn't really address security. It addresses privacy. And a lot of the training we do on the universities try to explain the difference between privacy and security. So the law in higher education, to the extent it existed several years ago, it focused on privacy. At this point and going into the future, obviously, there's going to be much more focus on the security issues. And even as we'll talk in a few slides, taking a look at some of the recent regulations in FERPA, some of the comments in FERPA, kind of help indicate what that forecast is. But we do have an alphabet soup of laws. Let's go ahead and hit the next slide. You know, but the compliance issues, as the castle, as John kind of talked about, as that castle comes down and our data is moved outside of that castle, then the issues from a legal standpoint, the issues from a contractual standpoint, as we're now dependent on various vendors keeping track of our information and keeping that confidential, that becomes more and more important. So, you know, at this point, the soup that we're dealing with, Gram Leach, Bliley, HIPAA, we've got numerous provisions in the Higher Education Opportunity Act, we've got P2P regulations. More and more law is evolving, more and more regulation is coming in, and it's not just striking IT security, but it's striking all the different departments throughout the university. Yesterday, there was an ECAR report that came out from EDUCAUSE, and it's talking about how, it's a very helpful, it's written by Nadine Stern, College of New Jersey. It's entitled Privacy and Confidentiality, Holding Service Providers Accountable. And New Jersey actually provides a template for what they would like to have their vendors follow pursuant to contract. But listen to this list. To the extent applicable to the performance of service provider under the agreement, those safeguards shall conform to the requirements of FERPA and its implementing regulations, Gram Leach Bliley, the Federal Trade Commission's standards for safeguarding customer information, the Fair and Accurate Credit Transactions Act of 2003, the Fair Credit Reporting Act, and regulations issued by the Federal Trade Commission, the Federal Bank Regulatory Agencies, the National Credit Union Administration, pursuant to the red flag rules, requiring financial institutions and creditors to develop and implement written identity theft protection programs. Collectively, these statutes and regulations may be hereafter referred to as the privacy laws. So we've moved far beyond where we were a number of years ago, where we had FERPA. And now we're playing in the big leagues. We're playing with the financial institutions. And that's going to be a real challenge for universities. And it does lend credibility to the importance of having a good working relationship, both from the legal office to ITS, but also vice versa. The result here is that the data security issues are going to be prevalent throughout the institution. At Baylor, I've dealt with privacy issues relating to our youngest kids that attend a children's education center, the toddlers. You know, we have one toddler get ill. We've got a influenza case. Now all of a sudden, you know, what are our regulations? How much privacy is that student attended to when the other parents are wanting to know what classroom was that child in? I've got a right to know if my child's been subjected or been exposed to various influenza diseases. We've also got at the other end of the spectrum, we deal with alumni databases. We line up different vendors to provide update services, kind of tracking to make sure that our current addresses, the addresses we have, stay current. So we've got it from, you know, literally cradle to grave. It's also important that you recognize that there's a need to break through the information silos. On this situation, on this issue, it's real important to recognize, just as Collins talked about earlier, ITS and the legal office are two departments within a university that are particularly well suited for being able to get into other people's business. And that perspective is good in that it allows us to peer into the different silos. And so often at a university setting like Baylor, that we can have departments that are perfectly happy with moving forward with their initiatives, moving forward with their directives. But as long as that information stays within that silo, then you can have incredibly inefficient decisions made for the institution. One example we had just a few weeks ago was at Baylor was our human resources department. Thought it'd be a great idea. Every year we do flu shots for the employees. Hey, it'd be a great idea if we set up a really easy way of setting up a payment stream. And so wouldn't it be great if all the employees could just swipe their card and we'd do it a payroll deduct and it'd be really great and easy. And so they call me and I kind of deal with the HIPAA issues and, you know, kind of dance around those. But the problem was, as long as that decision-making process was purely within HR, it seemed like a great deal. It was when I called my ITS friends and they're sitting there going, well, we don't have that set up. And it was next week and it's for 2 days. I mean, and we start dealing with, okay, is that really a good use of ITS resources? Not a legal decision, but it was an inefficient decision that the university was getting closer to making. So the importance is to not just stay focused on what the legal issues are, what the regulatory issues are, but through a good working relationship, as you'll see, you're able to actually make better decisions as an institution.
I think one of the keys of the relationship is really understanding the other guy's role. So for us, originally, what was ITS's role of legal or view of legal? They were the guys that we sent the contracts off to, and hopefully after about 6 months, the contracts would come back, right? And then we could move forward with our initiative. Really today, we've changed that drastically. We now look at general counsel as a partner. And where that's evolved, I mean, if you're in IT security, you know, you don't have a lot of friends. Well, general counsel doesn't have a lot of friends either. So it kind of make a great partnership for some friendship. I mean, you have a sounding board. You have somebody that you can go to and really say, hey, this is something that we're dealing with. What do you think? What's the legal implications here? understanding the new regulations. Over the last 2 to 3 years, we've seen so many new regulations that need interpretation, and leveraging and using their resources to understand how are those going to apply to our environment. How are we going to make sure that we're doing the right thing initially rather than trying to retrofit because we didn't understand the compliance initiatives in the first place? And I think that's some of the big mistakes we can make. We assume, well, that shouldn't apply to us. But until you really hear that from your general counsel and provide context for them, it can be very difficult to make sure that that's the case. So we've really moved from this role of they're up in the ivory tower and we send them the contracts to, hey, we're going to work with you. We're going to make you aware of the issues that we have. We're going to make sure that you're a sounding board, that you're working back and forth, and that there's benefits out of that relationship.
You know, I think our perspective on IT security is very similar to that of risk management at the end of the day. And that's, you know, basically keeping the data safe. And if the university is going to take a risk, make sure that that risk is an informed one, that you're making an informed decision based on that risk. And it's very similar to risk management. It's very similar to our audit department. So, you know, as we've moved forward with IT security, you know, basically understanding that part of the risk that they're assessing in order to make sure the institution is making an informed decision on that, a lot of that risk is legal in nature. It's regulatory in nature.
So now we want to talk a little bit about what are the results of this partnership? What have we gained from it? What are we using in the partnership that can really be seen in the environment? Good cop, bad cop. Advocacy and issue spotting, and then understanding the other's mission and what their risks are.
And before you actually cover this one, I think that I'm a little threatened by the fact that we got a lot of Baylor people in here. And this whole good cop, bad cop thing, John and I are just discussing this academically. We've never actually used this at Baylor.
So as you can imagine, there are many situations that we run across in IT security that are challenges, that are things that may be legal issues, privacy issues, things that need to be addressed or that may be headed down a path that we need to go back and say, can we do this differently? Is this the best decision from a security and privacy standpoint? I think the thing that you have to be careful of once you have this partnership is making sure first to use the correct voice. So is this something that's a technology security privacy issue, or is it truly a pure legal issue? And make sure the correct person is at the table to have that discussion with the department or the individuals that are facing the problem. In many cases, they don't even acknowledge there's a problem. In their minds, they're coming in, they're doing what they need to do for their department to function. They're not thinking from a risk perspective. You got to remember, we're the guys running around with the tinfoil hats, and everything's going to come down around us all the time. The rest of the university doesn't have that perspective. So you want to make sure that even when you're using this, you're using the correct person to make the conversation. The other thing, don't go legal every time. You don't want to be the boy who cried wolf or who's constantly running over to daddy saying, he hit me again, he hit me again, he hit me again. You want to make sure that when you're actually leveraging this relationship, it's in those cases where all of the other measures that you have traditionally used are ineffective in making the message take. So, you know, those things where they're going to go forward with the contract and that division has the approval or can go through and get signature authority and approval, and you know that contract's going to go through legal, that may be the case where you have to actually flag legal, and legal's going to be the one that has to say, okay, guys, there are issues here. And we know we're made aware of those issues, but you may have chose to ignore them or kind of go forward anyway. And so you want to be careful when using this relationship. It's not something where you guys want to be viewed as constantly they're the guys that say no. A lot of times IT security and legal can be viewed as the guys that say no. It's really making sure that we use the relationship in an effective way with the voice.
And actually, before you leave that slide, at Baylor, I'm talking to the attorneys, I think there's two or three. At Baylor, our office has got a real good relationship with the VPs. And so as a result, a lot of times the VPs will deliberately use our office as a sounding board, not necessarily get legal advice, but to make sure that even it makes sense on a business decision basis. That could be different at certain institutions. And it really kind of depends on the relationship with the vice president. But a lot of times we can see decisions that really don't make sense from a business standpoint. It's perfectly legal, But from a business standpoint, there may be an inefficient decision being made. It may just be we think that it actually needs to get elevated up to that VP, or it may need to get elevated up to a different VP, just to make sure that the institution knows what's going on. So a lot of times, just because we bring in our office of general counsel, it may not be necessarily for legal advice. And that's probably a little bit different than some institutions. And it really, it's kind of on a case-by-case basis, depending on what our relationship is with those VPs. Our office's relationship with the Baylor ITS group is real tight. And so as a result, we a lot of times will push back on other departments that are really drawing in ITS resources to kind of say, okay, look, you probably need to make sure you've talked about this with your VP, because you're really impinging on another department's resources. The advocacy and issue spotting is another benefit of having a close relationship. A lot of times, John and I will talk, and he'll make me aware of different issues that are coming up through other departments. It's kind of in a whisper mode. You know, hey, are you aware that the athletic department is getting ready to, you know, undertake this initiative? We're currently planning to resource it. We want to make sure that you're kind of aware that this contract's going to be coming down the pipeline. As John meets, or as ITS gets involved in these issues, what a lot of times happens is there's a voice that the legal department has through John, through Bob Hartland, through the people in ITS, whereby they can say, ooh, you better talk to legal about that. That may have an impact on them. Ooh, that's going to bring in a FERPA regulatory issue. Have you talked to legal about that? And what that enables is I don't have to go to every meeting, because ultimately I've got a theory that bringing an attorney to a meeting is like a guarantee that nothing's going to happen. And so a lot of times, well, I'll talk with them and say, okay, you know, you may not want to lawyer up. If you lawyer up at this meeting, then is that sending the right message? Is there a softer way to communicate what you need to? There's another benefit, and that is that because we've got more voices regarding the regulatory issues and the legal issues, it actually gives more of a profile to those issues. So as a result, throughout ITS, as those different groups are making decisions, they're constantly reminded, okay, have we checked with ITS security? Have we checked with the law office? We're going to be doing this type of use with our database. You know, that's a different change. Are we going to be okay on that? And so those two benefits are really key. But once again, they're only accessed by having a really good working relationship. It's also important to understand the other's mission. If I'm going to be an advocate for the ITS department, then I need to understand exactly what they're doing. I need to be able to recognize the risks that they're facing. Primarily, those are going to be of a resource issue. There may be technology feasibility things that stop, but typically, if ITS throws up its hand and says, we can't do that, it's technically impossible for us to do that, then that project will stop. It's the one where, oh, if we just threw more resources at it, if we just had more of your staff kind of working on this issue. And so when it's possible, I try to keep in mind what ITS is doing and what their risks are to them as an entity. I do the same thing for the other departments as well, though. So I work a lot with student life. And so if I see something coming out of the academic department that's going to have an impact on student life, once again, it may not be a legal issue, but if it's going to be a threat to their mission, if it's going to be a threat to their ability to carry out what they do for students, then I've got my contacts over there, and I may tip them to that and say, look, you may need to coordinate with student life before you as an academic department send out 9,000 email regarding your research project on student issues. So let's make sure we've coordinated with all the departments. Another area that we work a lot with ITS on is on policy creation review. Our office gets invited, and this is not one of my favorite things to do, but to sit in on a lot of the policy reviews. And as part of that process, whether we've got ITS reps there or not, I can keep in mind what ITS's perspectives are going to be, what their challenges are going to be, what their concerns are going to be with different policies. ITS does the same thing. As they go through their policies, they keep in mind the legal and regulatory issues. We've got two policies that we've spent a lot of time on that really intersect both the legal regulatory issues as well as the technology and security issues. And that is our technology use policy. It's BUPPO 2.6, if I remember correctly, 2.5. But basically what that does is it talks to our university community about how university resources can be used. And Baylor's perspective has been, and it sometimes is not the easiest battle to fight, but our perspective on that technology use policy is we do not try to tailor it. We do not chase the technology. We apply it across the board to all technologies. So when the new smartphones come out, now people have got more email on their systems, and is that FERPA information? Well, we're not really going to try to chase down, well, we're going to have a smartphone policy. Oh, and now we got to have a thumb drive policy. Oh, and now we got to have a laptop policy. We're not going to focus on what the different media is that the information is being out on. What we're going to do is we're going to say, across the board, this is the way you can use our systems. Phone systems, exact same. Wireless systems, exact same. Laptops, servers, it's all the exact. Same thing on the information use policy. We're not going to try to tailor exactly what the media is. We're going to basically say, these are our policies, and these are going to apply. And what's the benefit of that is that as new technology comes out, we don't have to go and try to update our policies on it. As new uses come out, we're not behind the eight ball trying to catch up with that. I was reading in preparation for today, I was going back over Lessig, who's coming tomorrow to talk, keynote, y'all need to go. He wrote a book called Code 2.0, and the Supreme Court kind of adopted this analysis too in the Katz Supreme Court cases dealing with wiretapping. And what it was talking about was the United States Constitution, the freedom of privacy that we have. And Katz basically said, we're not going to get caught up in whether or not the government's having to physically trespass on your property. We're not going to get caught up in what the media is. What we're going to do is we're going to take a look at the privacy right that Americans have. And if the government impinges on that privacy right. So take a look at the principle behind the Constitution. And our policies are kind of the same thing. I didn't know that we'd done it that way. I thought that was a pretty interesting point. So our policies are kind of taking a look at the principles. And we're not going to be too concerned about exactly what the media is by which that information is being used or by which that information is being stored. And that requires a lot of education efforts throughout the university. One of the ways that I'm guessing, after I got into Baylor, I was shocked at the number of contracts that were coming through our office for approval that had never seen the light of day in ITS. And they were technology contracts. So engineering department wants to get some new drafting software, put it up on the system. Well, they're doing it, and our legal, and I'm looking at it, and I'm like approving it, and all of a sudden I'm hearing cries and screams from ITS. We don't have the resources. Seriously, you're putting a video streaming in that building? Because right now we don't have enough bandwidth to that building. And so there was no coordination. And so as a result, Baylor's adopted a policy whereby in order to get a contract reviewed through our office, we've actually got a cover sheet. And one of the main things on that cover sheet is, have you coordinated with ITS if this is a software resource? And about 80% of them use it. We haven't gotten 100% of use, but we do make sure that they get that check mark in there. And we're making sure that they're coordinating with risk management to regarding the insurance issues and things like that. But we wanted to make sure that everybody knew that they needed to coordinate with ITS before the contract came to us, not after. It's not my job to make sure it's coordinated with ITS. Now, just between us, I do that. But we want them to kind of take that initiative on their own. And as we talked about earlier, that both the legal office is then going to be tipping ITS off to different issues that might come up. you know, and ITS is also going to be working to kind of give me heads up regarding different issues or different uses of data that might cause problems from my perspective.
So now we're going to kind of talk about some of the key areas that we're working to address. Data security, FERPA compliance, privacy, student issues, and employment issues. To start off with the data security issues, I think we've seen from the presentations that are scheduled for the next 3 days, the buzzword is definitely cloud. We all know that. Everything's going to the cloud in some form or fashion, and that is going to present significant challenges in the IT security and legal realms. Many of those traditional controls we've talked about are now gone. You're not going to be putting the firewall in place. You're not going to be doing any of those things. You're now going to have to look at things like SAS 70 compliance. Do these organizations have a set of security policies, privacy practices in place? And when they are audited, do they actually meet those policies that they've set forth? So the controls that they have implemented, do they actually meet that requirement? That's what you have to realize with SAS 70. SAS 70 primarily says, do you say what you're going to do? And do you actually do what you're going to do? So you need to follow up. Just somebody saying they are SAS 70 compliant, that's not real helpful, because that can mean that they say, we sell your data to anybody who they want to. And the auditor says, yep, they do that. Okay, here's a SAS 70. So be very aware of what that means. You have to be very proactive in going in and researching that. Just because it has the tag letters, you know, hey, we're compliant with SAS 70, doesn't mean that it's going to meet the controls and privacy requirements that you are going to be looking for in your organization. Contract issues. Contracts are amazing. We have to realize that these contracts are written by attorneys who work for the vendors, who work for the organizations that you're contracting with. Their priority is not to go in and provide you with data privacy, with data breach notification, with warranties, with data recovery obligations. And the list goes on and on with regards to the regulations as well. So as you go through and you read these contracts, which it's interesting, Chris and I have discovered, you know, sometimes you'll get a contract and the person that's submitting it hasn't even read it. You know, they say, well, I'm not an attorney, I don't read contracts. And it's like, if you really go through it there and just look at the general language, you're going to have an idea if this organization is doing something that you would find appropriate with your data and service. SLAs become extremely important. If you're going out and you're putting a mission critical service into the cloud for student management, and you find out, well, you know, the service goes down, they're going to guarantee it'll be back up in 2 weeks. Can your university survive those levels of SLAs? So we're changing, and that the technology controls aren't really what we're looking at as much. It's much more to policy, contracts, SLAs, these types of controls. In addition, making sure that we have non-disclosure agreements. If you do have contractors coming in and working on systems, or even with student workers and employees, making sure you have those tight non-disclosure agreements so that you have something to stand on if there is an issue. Sadly, a lot of this, as you can imagine, is reactive. We put it in place only that if there's an issue, then we can then use it. We're not actually able to prevent the issue from happening in the first place, which is what we like to do in IT security. We like to put up the IPS system and the firewall to prevent it from happening. Well, we're having to realize that when things go to the cloud, we may not be the ones able to proactively prevent the incident from happening. We're having to have these reactive controls in place. So in some ways, we're taking a little bit of a step backwards. It's kind of like where you had the virus outbreak and you went out there and you patched all the computers and you cleaned up the virus and got the network running again. Cloud's a new environment. We're having to take a step back and realize that when we talk about the IT security.
Basically, what John and I did for the next couple slides is we talked about everything that we've been talking about the last couple months. So if John calls me up, I mean, these are the issues that we're kind of chewing on a regular basis. One of the ones that came up, December 2008, FERPA was updated, the regulations, new regulations came out. Those did a couple of different things that really impact ITS. The first one is that vendors are required to be under the direct control of the higher education institutions they're working for. And this is kind of what's focused on that ICAR report that came out yesterday, saying, hey, look, we need to go back in. We need to kind of have a contractual addendum. We need to make sure that those institutions are subject to our control. And not surprisingly, I've got two vendors that I'm actually hunting down this week, This is my first time at EDUCAUSE, so I've never actually gotten to see any of them. So, but I've got two contracts where it's just, I'm dealing with it, and FERPA regulations, it's like they're deaf. I mean, they're not hearing. And I'm saying, you got to be subject to our direct control. We're not subject to anybody's direct control. Do you understand how big we are? No, you have to be. I mean, if you're going to work in the higher education field, you got to be subject to FERPA. Yeah, that's great. We are. We're subject to FERPA. No, I need you in writing. No, we're not going to put it in writing. So I'm hunting them down. If you guys want to follow me afterwards, I'm on a quest. So, but the contractual issues here are difficult. Another area is, and I'm going to read this quote, an educational institution must use reasonable methods to identify and authenticate the identity of parties to whom the institution discloses personally identifiable information from education records. This is kind of getting at the registrar's office. If they're going to release some information, now the institution, before the FERPA just said, hey, look, as long as you're releasing it to the student, or you've got a consent from the student, you're fine. Notice what the regulation did. You can't take the student's word for it anymore. Now, my view would have always been unreasonable to take the student's word for it. But so we're having to go in and we're actually having to train our registrar department and different areas that frequently interact with parents and students to make sure, hey, you've got an obligation to make sure that you're reasonably certain that that's actually the student. Now, how do you go about doing that? Maybe it's an ID card. Maybe it's a couple of questions over the phone for a transcript request. It's a couple of questions that might help us verify that that's actually the student. But FERPA actually affirmatively requires that before it did. Another area that has long been the reasonable and prudent thing to do, a good thing for the institution to do, is we use Banner, right? Okay. So on Banner, we've got role-based access. So I, as the attorney for the university, I got no access to Banner. Don't want it. All right, which is good. That's role-based access. Now then, Becky King back there, who's with Baylor, and she's like the Uber person over Banner. All the people under her, Banner. She's got like a whole lot of access, I'm guessing, right? All right. Or the people that are working on Banner have got a whole lot of access. Now, from an academic perspective, if I'm the Dean of Arts and Sciences, I may have access to certain student data that's going to be with Arts and Sciences. If they're coming over from the business school to take a philosophy course, I may not be able to access their information. And that's the way Baylor's been set up. But what's happened now, December 2008, FERPA affirmatively requires that. That if you've got databases out there, your databases should be set up in a way so that you're paying attention to what that school official's role at that institution is, and then based on that, you're going to provide them with access or not. Finally, and this is kind of an interesting issue. FERPA, as it was originally adopted, is a statute, right? Okay, so, and let's go back to constitutional law. The executive departments only get to do what Congress tells them to do, right? And so when FERPA was originally passed, it's a privacy law. It's a privacy law. It's a confidentiality. This document is confidential. Nowhere in the statute does it say anything about security. That wasn't important at the time. Contrast that with HIPAA. HIPAA came out, all the health records are confidential, all the health records are private. And then what immediately followed? The safeguards rules. So now we've got privacy and confidentiality, and we've got security. FERPA as a statute doesn't address security. And that's starting to make the Department of Education a little nervous, right? And so what the Department of Education did in the comments, in the regulations, is they started making recommendations regarding security. Now, EDUCAUSE can make recommendations regarding security. Are they binding on you? No. Department of Education can make recommendations regarding security. Are they binding on you? Technically, no. Because Congress never told them, oh yeah, go out there and adopt regulations regarding security. Now then, Is it good for your institution to be aware of what those recommendations are? Absolutely. Does it indicate that we're going to see more and more laws introducing security requirements? Absolutely. What's happened here is the Department of Education is recognizing that FERPA is behind the times, and they're trying to cover it up as best they can, which I don't have a problem with them trying to do that. I got a problem a little bit with an agency going outside the scope of its statute, and that tends to make me a little nervous. But be aware that there are security recommendations that are in these comments. A number of different privacy issues come up that John and I tend to talk about quite a bit. Main thing here is just because we have access to it doesn't mean it's a good idea for us to use it. We get a lot of departments that'll say, boy, it sure would be nice to know. I'll give you a student life example. Sure would be nice to know when Betty Sue, so we're Baylor, Waco, Texas, everybody's named Betty Sue. All right, when Betty Sue accessed her dormitory. And so sure enough, does John have access to that information? I guess you do.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we got the card swipes and things like that. Can we get access to that information? Absolutely. But just because we've got access to it, just because we've got it, doesn't mean it's a good idea for us to use it. And so a lot of times if John's getting squeezed on or ITS is getting squeezed by another department to use information in a manner in which it was not originally anticipated, then they'll give me a call, heads up. And that way I can get involved and say, okay, look, I understand that we've got a question regarding this employee and whether they're working hard during the day. But doing a black bag operation on their computer is not the way to go about doing it and try to figure out what websites he's been hitting. There's other ways for us to take a look at that employee's, at whether or not that employee is doing their work. But we're not going to do this type of stuff. And so, do we have access to it? Yeah, we can go and get his hard drive. It's on a Baylor University computer. Our policies clearly state that Baylor University computers are Baylor University's. We can do anything we want to with them. But we're not going to engage in that behavior. We can, but that doesn't mean it's a good idea. Only request and retain the information required. This is one of the things that was actually referenced in the Washington Post article. And it's something that we do. One of the interesting things, right after I got to Baylor, the athletic department was using the old stock for the season ticket renewals. It had a spot in there for Social Security number. I call them, why are you guys using Social Security number? Oh, we don't. Why are you asking for it? Well, because those are the old forms we've used, and we've just had to print out new ones. How long have you been doing this? Oh, years. But you don't even use it. Right. Okay, let's not have it on our form, and they followed that. So don't necessarily access that. Don't take that data in if you're not going to need it. We have a lot of different student issues. The social networking, slander sites, Juicy Campus. What are we going to do about that? I can never remember the name of the group.
College ACB.
We have issues relating to honor codes and disciplinary codes, and these are departments that would really like to be able to access additional information that ITS may have. But the further we get out of, outside of the way that information is typically used, the less comfortable we are. Working with campus police on an investigation of a crime, then we may have video access. We may have access to when the student last ate in their dorm, at the cafeteria. I mean, all this kind of stuff can present big brother issues, and we're kind of there working together to make sure that there's still, to the extent that we can, we honor the students' and the employees' expectations of privacy. And finally, a Baylor policy does allow us to kind of maintain. Maintain information. So a lot of times, if we're anticipating a litigation issue, I'll call it, we hadn't gotten sued or anything like that. I'll call up John and just say, hey, can you make a copy of that PST file of that employee? John doesn't have the access. John's never going to look at it. I may never look at it, but we've got it. We've got it maintained. And so what we may do is, if we know that there's an issue coming out of an academic department relating to tenure denial, we may actually go ahead and make copies of PSD files just to maintain it. but nobody will ever necessarily take a look at it. And then if that issue got resolved, there's no litigation, then I mean that information gets destroyed. But if it does come up, that way we know that we've got that backup copy out there. A lot of different employee issues come up. E-discovery is one I just mentioned. At Baylor, as a private institution, we're not subject to open records laws. I know that a lot of your public institutions and email and relating to employees is a lot more problematic. Baylor, one of the issues we kind of deal with occasionally is on political speech. As we get into a campaign year, employees want to send out email regarding their campaign decisions or political beliefs, we kind of have to be careful to make sure that they're not speaking on behalf of Baylor University, that they're doing that as an individual. And then we also, a lot of times, we'll deal with either criminal activity or involuntary terminations. And involuntary terminations tend to, those situations, the funny thing we've had there is where employees have stored a lot of personal data on their computer. They get involuntarily terminated, and now all of a sudden, we're escorting them out the building, and they want to get, all my pictures of the kids for the last 8 years are on my hard drive. What are you guys going to do? So actually, if you have a solution to that one, that's what we're dealing with right now. So if you have a solution to that one, come talk to us afterwards. So.
I think with that, we'd like to open up to questions. I think we've got about 5 minutes left. We've got some questions from the audience.
Sure. The question is, what's Baylor's approach regarding cloud computing? Thus far, the contracts that have come through that are really cloud or SA, SaaS oriented are going to be situations where Baylor is actually contracting with a specific vendor still. I assume I can talk about this. If I get into attorney-client stuff, you guys shut me up. But I think one of the issues we've been talking about is outsourcing to Blackboard the ability to provide a backup to
business continuity
backup. So so they've got all of our content. Now then, from a contractual perspective, I don't really view that as much different as what we had before, where we had our content, it was stored on our servers, but they still had a whole lot of access to it. So from a FERPA standpoint, it was kind of the same issue regarding the confidentiality. I kind of already had to make sure that they knew they were subject to FERPA. Now that information's moved out, I think from a contractual perspective, it may not give me, the contract may not look that different. I got concerns on the addendum issue. Not necessarily with Blackboard, the contract itself is going to look fairly similar. Now, what may happen is that responsibility to continue to act reasonably and make sure that Blackboard is a good company. They haven't had a history. John's been up to talk to them regarding how they're encrypting. We've taken all those steps. That's kind of where more of my concern is this company going to be there? Do we know where they're located? Are you comfortable from an ITS security standpoint? Have you asked them the questions? Have you had those conversations? And if you get comfortable with that, then I'm a whole lot more comfortable. But we're just now catching up with that as well. And this afternoon, the Tracy Matrano's group at 4 o'clock or 4:50 that ICPL, show up to that, because my understanding is that's going to be a big topic at that meeting.
I think the other thing with that is we know about a lot of the cloud stuff coming through the general counsel's office. It's a department going to do something. Where we have to be very concerned, and it comes back to education, is making sure people are aware of information use policies so they don't just take the departmental credit card and run out there and hop into the Amazon cloud or any other service that's out there and start populating a lot of information. So, and a lot of that goes back to is making sure people understand what is the use policy? What am I supposed to do with what kind of data? And we have to back off a little bit from an IT security perspective in that, we're not going to control all the low-level data that has little to minimal risk. That can go out in the cloud, but when we get to the level that we're talking about student records, we don't want somebody going and using a departmental, or even worse, and I've heard this in corporate America, personal credit cards to start securing infrastructure in the cloud that later the organization may not even have a right to access.
Yeah.
Question in the back.
Yeah, the problem, dude, you don't know what country it's
in. We are adding that. We have added that in our contracts, that if they plan to move outside of the continental U.S., that they need to notify us, that they have to give us a reasonable notification before doing that. Because, and this is, goes back to, and Canada has the, what they call the Anti-Patriot Act, where they're not supposed to be moving data into the United States. Likewise, we want to make sure from our perspective, because of the regulations, that we don't have data moving outside of the United States, outside of U.S. law, without our knowledge. So we've included that in contracts that have cloud.
Right.
We're at time? Okay. I think we're at time. We'll probably be here for a few minutes. If there's some other questions, please try to complete the evaluations, and thank you.
Thanks a lot.